A house is made of wood and stone, but only love can make a home. Welcome to the Repco Light Home Improvement Show, helping you make your home into one you'll love even more. Here are your hosts, Dan Hansen and Betsy Thompson.
Well, good morning, everybody. Happy Saturday. We're glad you're out there. You got your cup of coffee ready to go.
Yes, I do.
With
thank
the
you.
Repco Light Home Improvement Show logo emblazoned on the mug, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Right? We should have those made.
Sure.
Repco Light Home Improvement Show coffee mugs.
I'll get right on that.
Okay. You get on that.
Mm-hmm.
And fill mine up with fresh coffee while you're at it.
You are
Dan
asking
Hansen,
a lot.
And I'm asking for coffee.
Yeah. And I'm Betsy Thompson.
And you're not
going
to bring
saying
it.
No. No, but what I am saying yes to is old homes. We're going to talk about old and historic homes today with Sharon Ferraro. She's the historic preservation coordinator from Kalamazoo. And just in talking to her, she knows so much. She's an absolute wealth of information. Everybody's going to want to stay tuned for that segment.
Yeah, that's a good segment. Yep. Betsy says, say yes to old homes. She's going to put that on a placard, maybe on a mug.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Exactly. We'll also keep our Q&A and money giveaway going.
Mm-hmm.
That's exciting.
Yes.
We'll answer a question that we received on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll also dole out a cool $50 cash to the asker of the question.
Yes, everyone's excited for that. But first, in another self-serving Dan segment.
Good grief.
We have Lenny Manning from Zagger's Pool and Spa here with us. And I know you're on the edge of your seat.
I just need to get some things figured out, Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
And Lenny's going to help us with that. Lenny, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things I want, I mean, top of my list, I've got a big list of things that I want to really, really have. And on the top of that list is a hot tub.
Awesome.
But I there are so many things that confuse me. What do I need to do when I'm starting the process? And for anybody listening who's toying with the idea of a hot tub, where do we start?
Well, couple things. One thing that you want to make sure is that you have your electrical ready to go. Generally, you'll need 220. Most hot tubs will run on either 40 or 50 amp. But we would recommend 60 amp because that allows both jets and the heater to work at the same time. So
okay.
In the winter, it's a little nicer experience.
Okay.
But they will hook up 40 or 50 amp also. From there, the electrician, depending on how much room you have in your electrical box, may need to add some more spots for it. But otherwise, in most cases, they just run it outside to a shutoff box or a cutoff box.
Mm-hmm.
And that just needs to be 5 feet away from the hot tub and no more than 15 feet.
The electrician will come and do all of that part.
Absolutely.
Now, is this an expensive procedure?
Your house and what you already have plays a big role. So if you have an electrical box that's already hooked up, you're going to run it directly out, put the cutoff box outside, and then put the tub right there, and you're set to go. It's usually not too bad. If you're going to run it much further or you need to add room to your box, then it could be a little bit more costly.
Okay, but I can talk to an electrician and get an idea about that.
Absolutely.
When I'm ready.
In fact, we can contact you with electricians who'll be more than happy to get some ideas. They can even have where you send them pictures and they'll give you a rough idea of what it'll
okay.
cost.
That's very
not bad.
Cool.
Okay, now you said you recommend a 60 amp circuit. If it's a bigger tub, you know, I know there's like two person and then there's however many.
Well, like
so you can
I have 27
party.
People in my family.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. So if you are looking at a bigger tub, do you have to have more power to it or does it not matter?
Well, the power doesn't matter as far as the jets. The difference
okay.
will be if you have it hooked up like 40 amp
mm-hmm.
and you have two pumps, you mm-hmm. turn both pumps on and the heater will shut off. So in the wintertime when you go to use it, you can have the jets running, but no heat going to it.
That doesn't seem to be as hot that way, right?
Right. I mean, it'll be
really?
Hot when you first get in it, but it will generally cool down. So most people, after 20, 30 minutes of the jets running, we'll notice a difference in the temperature.
Okay.
So if you can hook it up 60 amp, it's a little bit more enjoyable in the wintertime.
Okay.
Not necessary, but is better.
All right. Okay, so the electrical part, that's where we start.
Yep.
What's next?
So after the electrical part, then you just need a spot to put it. Generally, hot tubs can sit in lots of different situations and areas, mm-hmm. such as you can put them on a deck, a concrete slab. You can also just do paving stones. You can do pea stones on them. We also sell spa pads. So if you have the area already level, we'll go ahead and install the spa pads for you.
Okay.
Lots of options.
So I want to go back to this deck thing. We have a deck right outside our back door, which is where a lot of people choose to place their decks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not special. I'm not trying to rub anybody's noses in it. My deck is just in the backyard.
Right.
Anyway, the point is, I don't have a raised deck. It's on the ground.
Okay.
So that's okay with the weight of a hot tub, because this has been an ongoing debate with my wife and I. She says it's fine, no problem. And I got a feeling from what you said earlier, it's probably fine, no problem.
Most likely she's right, but depending on your deck. I mean, if it's some dilapidated...
It's a pretty
wiggly
nice deck.
Thing,
it's
then
a pretty, hey,
absolutely not.
It's not, because this is me.
Good point.
Right.
And I didn't build it, so it's solid. It's pretty good.
That says it all right there.
Will you guys be able to come out and assess that? I'm assuming that, right? You'll come out and can you put it on a deck that's raised?
Absolutely.
Okay, as long as it's
solid.
Sound and solid. Well, I was concerned with all the water and all of that. The weight of it was too much.
Filled with water and people in it, they generally average about 100 pounds per square foot.
So I didn't even think about the people in it.
They're not that bad.
Oh, really? Oh, see, once I would have thought about the people, I'd have figured it's a death trap. But it's funny.
No,
you can put it on a deck.
Absolutely.
Well, that opens up a whole vista of things that I've never concerned or considered before.
Right.
So I can put it there. So I'm figuring out this place. Is there a certain distance from the house it's got to be?
Yeah. So from where they have the cutoff box outside, the electrician, the tub needs to be at least 5 feet away from that, but it can't be more than 15.
Okay. So but it's not so much concerning with the house.
No.
It's just that box.
Yep.
Okay.
In fact, the closer that you put the tub to the house, the more you'll use it, especially in the winter. We highly recommend putting them closer than further.
Yeah, mine is like just down a set of steps because I don't want to run.
Betsy's rubbing my nose in the fact that she's got a hot tub I want one and don't have one.
Oh, poor
baby. Right.
Okay.
But it sounds like it's possible. I'm getting closer.
Yes, it is possible, I'm guessing. I do have one quick question. I know somebody who has a hot tub and it is inside, and that has always baffled me. Like, it's in their house on a back porch. Doesn't that create moisture problems? I had never seen
Absolutely.
That before.
In fact, if you're going to put a hot tub indoors, you want to make sure you have plenty of ventilation. You don't want mold and things like that. Keeping it covered definitely helps, but you've got to have ventilation if you're going to have a tub indoors.
We're talking with Lenny Manninga from Zegers Pool and Spa. And we're talking about hot tubs, trying to take the mystery out of it for me. Because
yes.
I just don't know.
Because
all
it's
the things.
Another self-serving dance.
Well, it is. I want one really badly, I want to iron out some of these questions that I've got. And we're getting really close. The next big question that I have, and I think it's really my last big question, is the expense of running it.
Actually, depending on the tubs that you get, a lot of it will have to do with the amount of insulation. Most of our tubs would be 100% fully foamed, and you're probably somewhere less than $1 a day operating cost.
Does it depend on how often the cover comes off or how long it's off? I mean, I'm thinking the dead of winter, and if the cover's off for 6 hours because the kids are hanging out in it, does it cost more because you're trying to heat that water for so long and it's so cold?
It does.
Okay.
You lose most of your heat out of the lid. So having the cover off of it, especially in the winter, can cost more.
Okay.
But most common, if you plan $1 a day and you buy a decent hot tub, that should cover it.
When I'm talking about a decent hot tub, I mean, just give me a ballpark range of prices for the tubs themselves. I know there's all kinds of different options.
Yeah.
Just kind of help me wrap my brain around. I'm sitting down and I'm bracing myself.
Really, for something that's going to be efficient in a decent hot tub, they generally start somewhere around $5,000 to $6,000, and you're welcome to spend anywhere up to about $20,000.
Just depending
on what you want.
$20,000.
That means it comes with speakers and special cup holders and Bluetooth.
And a butler named Jeeves who brings me everything I want and fans me when I'm too hot.
Right.
Right?
And feeds
me
grapes.
Wow.
Yep.
$20,000 hot tub.
Yeah,
I'd like to just be in one.
The whole neighborhood will be in your yard.
Is it super big? What is in a $20,000 hot tub?
Well, obviously all the bells and whistles, but you can also get jets that you can swim against. So you can use it
so
as like
get
a swim
exercise.
Spa. Yep.
Which is the opposite of what I was thinking when it comes to hot tubs.
Uh-huh.
I'm thinking about relaxing.
Uh-huh. So you don't want the kids in there with you,
no,
is what you're saying. You better get a two-person hot tub then.
Yeah. So is there a particular time of year that you can install or can't install? I guess I'm curious about now, winter. Can they be installed now or do I got to wait?
No, absolutely. We can install them year-round. Does not matter. During the wintertime, we'll bring a spa sled, basically, and we'll just pull it on back to where it needs to go.
That alone sounds really cool.
I knew you
were
gonna
say
that.
I want to see a spa sled.
And then you're going to want to try it out, huh?
I want the spa on the sled, heated up.
With you in it.
Horses pulling me through the neighborhood.
Of course.
On my spa sled. Is it what I'm thinking it is, Lenny? Or is it different than what I'm imagining?
I can't read your mind, but I'm going to assume if you think it's a sled, then yes.
Okay. So... You're
going to be wearing a t-shirt in your spa because you don't want all the neighborhood seeing you in your swimsuit.
No,
sure.
I don't want them to see my very, very white flesh. So I'll cover it with a t-shirt, but I will still let them know I have a hot tub as I parade up and down the streets. So Lenny, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or anybody at Zegers, how's the best way to do that?
Honestly, you can stop into any of the 5 locations. Everybody is extremely knowledgeable and would be more than happy to help you, but you're also more than welcome to call and you can email us right from our website, and we'll definitely get back to everybody.
Excellent. Lenny Manninga from Zegers Pool and Spa, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, absolutely, guys. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Well, coming up after the break, we're going to answer another paint question, Betsy.
Woohoo!
And give away another $50.
Even better.
To find out who gets it, stay tuned.
Helping you turn your house into your dream home. This is the Repco Light Home Improvement Show, presented by Benjamin Moore on News Radio Wood 1300 and 106.9 FM.
Well, Betsy, it's the answer a question and give away money segment.
It is.
That's pretty exciting.
People love this segment.
Well,
especially last week's winner.
They do.
She was so excited. I met her in the store when she came in to pick up her gift certificate, and she's already working on the project. She is over the moon that she won, and she asked if she could win again this week, and I said, no, it's somebody else's turn.
But she could win again if she's got a really good question.
I told her she had to ask another question and maybe in a couple of weeks.
Because we're going to keep this going.
Yes.
Just go to Facebook, ask your question, and if we pick it and answer it on the air, we'll give you $50.
Right.
This week, we've picked Deborah Vliet, and the question she asked is this: what's the best type of brush to use when painting a house?
Yes.
Now, it's a good question, but it's honestly a little tough to answer on the radio. Now, because if you came into the store, we'd have a bunch of other questions to ask first. You know, we'd want to know what you're applying. Is it oil-based paint? Is it latex paint? Is it stain? You know, it could be any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
What surface are you painting? Smooth siding, rough wood, all of those things matter.
Right. And how much brushing do you really intend to do? Are you just cutting in or are you painting the entire exterior of your house with that brush? That will make a difference
There's tons of questions.
Yes.
And, you know, since we can't really answer anything on the radio by asking you five more questions and waiting for you to respond, we're going to actually just move into giving you a generic overview that should help you understand all of this confusion that you see in the brush aisle. There's a reason for all the different shapes that you see, the sizes, and the different filaments that are available.
Right.
And once you understand that, choosing a brush becomes very, very simple.
Yes.
And let's just start with bristles, you know, the filaments, the basic part of the brush.
Right.
Although the handle's important, too, because if you just had bristles, that'd be a real pain in the neck to hold on to.
Yes. Maybe we can go through all the parts of a brush in a different segment.
Let's just focus on bristles.
Yes. Let's just start by focusing on the bristles, because there are two main types of bristles. There's the natural bristle.
Or China bristle.
Right. Or there's the synthetic brush, which is a man-made material.
Right.
So your natural bristle brushes are going to be made of ox or hog hair, something like that.
Squirrel hair, rabbit hair.
Sure.
Probably not.
I don't think so. Those aren't, you know, quite stiff enough to put on paint. They're a little too fuzzy.
Really, really clean hogs, right?
Yes.
That's what I want to keep telling myself.
Yes.
That's a little weird. But it's hog's hair, ox hair, those kinds of things.
Right.
You would use a natural bristled brush for applying oil-based products.
Correct.
You know, stains or paints. You use them with polyurethanes. Use them with varnishes, things like that.
Right.
You don't want to use them for water-based paint.
No, never use them for that.
Yeah, don't use a natural bristled brush to apply water-based paint, because the natural bristles absorb the water from the paint, and then they completely go limp. They completely lose their shape.
Yes.
It's really hard to work
with. I've seen it happen.
I've done
it. It is a disaster.
Yeah, I did it without thinking and noticed right away the whole brush is completely drooped over. Very hard to work with.
Yes. At that point, you might as well throw it away.
Yeah.
Now, the other type of bristle is a synthetic bristle. Now, these can be made made from nylon, maybe polyester, or a combination of the two. And there's actually a newer bristle to the market. It's called the Chinex bristle.
Now, it's still a synthetic.
Yes.
But it's a new filament manufactured by DuPont.
Yeah, aren't they known for, like, other
things? All kinds of things. But what they've got is this bristle that's really, really easy to clean up.
Yes.
That's probably the thing I like best about it.
Mm-hmm.
With these brushes, the Chinex filament, you can get them full of paint, run them under running water for about 30, 40 seconds, mm-hmm. and most of that paint releases. Very easy to get them clean.
Yeah, it's one of our favorite brushes. We talk about it all the time on the show here. We usually recommend the Corona Excalibur. We both own one. Fantastic brush. If you want to try these out, that's the brush to
try. They're pushing the $20 range,
but
under
it's
$20.
So
bucks.
Worth it.
It
they
is
last,
gonna
last
forever.
Forever.
Yes. Great brush. Definitely want to get that.
Yes.
The synthetic bristles, the Chinex brush and the other ones that we talked about, all of those can be used to apply water-based or oil-based paint.
Right. We're talking paint brushes on the Repcolite Home Improvement Show, and we've talked about the different bristles of a brush. That's the best place to start. Now, there are two different main styles out there. There's a flat sash brush. Say that 10 times fast.
Flat? No, I can't. I can barely speak.
I know. Or there's an angle sash brush. Now, the flat sash is not quite as common as the angle sash. It's where the bristles are cut straight across. There's obviously no angle to them at all. And it's used typically for smooth doors, walls, and quite often exterior siding.
Basically, any flat surface that you don't want to roll or that you can't roll,
right.
You would use one of these flat sash brushes.
Right.
Now, the other style of brush is an angled sash, and that's basically where the bristles are cut on a slant, obviously.
Right.
And they're excellent cut-in brushes. That's the main place that we see these used.
Yep.
They're perfect for cutting in around windows, around trim, in corners, up to this where the wall meets the ceiling, all of those areas. You'll get a nice straight line with these.
Yeah, they're by far the most common brush out there. It's generally, if you look in a painter's van or truck, that's what they've got in there.
But some of the older painters just swear by the straight cut
that
brushes.
Is true, because they used to paint the entire wall with one of those.
So some of it is just what you get used to and what you feel comfortable with.
Right. Now, the last thing to consider is the size of a brush. Now, a lot of people think that, you know, bigger is better, and that is not the case, because it becomes a little bit cumbersome. And then there are people who think, well, a smaller brush is going to give me more control,
a straighter line if I've got to do my cut-in work. We see people go to these tiny little, even artist brushes, and that does not work at all.
No.
It's actually going to give you a worse cut-in line because the brush doesn't carry any paint. So you're constantly going over the same section trying to get it to cover. Doesn't work.
Right.
We recommend a bigger brush for that. And typically, most of the time, you're going to be fine if you go with a 2 to 2.5 inch brush. That'll work for most jobs.
Right. Now, you can use a 3 or 4 inch brush if you're doing some outdoor work, especially if you're going to paint your siding or stain it.
Yeah, then
also
bigger
for decks.
Is better.
Exactly.
You're going to have Popeye arms, but that'll be okay.
Right. Who doesn't love Popeye arms without the spinach? Exactly. Now, of course, there's all kinds of other stuff that we can dig into when it comes to paintbrushes, but those are the basics that you need to know. That'll
and
at least get you started.
Only so much paintbrush talk that you can listen to on a Saturday
morning. But if you have questions, come into any Repcolite or Port City Paints. We'll help you get the right brush for whatever you're doing.
And Deborah, we'll be in contact with you via Facebook to figure out the best way to get you your gift certificate. Everybody else, keep asking. Maybe you win next week. Who knows?
Exactly. Now, I have to tell you, I am ready for the next segment. I have my signs ready that say yes to old homes. I am ready for Sharon to come in and talk to us and share her knowledge. I am very excited.
I can tell.
And everyone else will be too. Stay tuned.
Helping you turn your house into your dream home. This is the Repcolite Home Improvement Show, presented by Benjamin Moore on News Radio Wood 1300 and 106.9 FM.
Well, the history geek across from me is driving me nuts. So let's just get straight into this segment, because, Betsy, you're basically drooling at the table. You're so excited.
Well, yes, because I do love history, and we are going to talk about old homes, and that is very exciting to me.
That is cool.
Yes, that's why I've asked Sharon Ferraro, she's the Historic Preservation Coordinator for Kalamazoo, to come and talk about these things, because she is exceptionally knowledgeable when it comes to historic homes.
Both of us look kind of dumb.
Oh, she's going to make us look bad. Erin. Thanks for being here.
Oh, happy to be here.
Okay, so today we want to talk about why people would want to buy an old home, but let's take a quick step back and differentiate between an old home and a historic home, because there is a difference, I'm guessing.
An old house is any house you think is old.
Okay.
There's no official designation for that.
It's, okay.
You know, I've had so many people say, well, that can't be old. My mother had a house like that. Or that can't be old. My grandmother had a house like that. Well, an old house is anything you think is old.
Okay.
So what usually most people would say that a house is more than 15 to 20 years old, and they might begin to consider it old, depending on their age.
Well, okay. That makes me old then.
That's right. Okay, that's a perfect one. Because then there's a historic house.
Okay.
Now, historic house usually implies that it's much older than that.
Okay.
The federal government, through the National Park Service, have established kind of a benchmark for historic, and the first hurdle is 50 years or more old, which makes me historic. Okay.
Oh, you're almost there, Dan.
I'm almost historic, but not quite.
But that's like the first thing. Now, you can have a historic house that's a designated historic house. And that's what we think of when we think of, is it listed on the National Register? So that means it must be really important.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it in a local historic district? That's historic.
Okay.
So that's a historic house that someone has gone through the effort to document how old it is, what's special about it, and if it's a district, why is that entire area special, not just the individual house? Because sometimes a house by itself, even if it's in perfect shape, it's interesting, it's historic, but it's the only one left on the block. It's really not all that interesting.
Right.
But if it's surrounded by 50 houses that are within 10 years of that, and they were all interconnected in some way, then you've got a district, and that's what really makes it interesting to people. Now, there's two levels of historic.
Okay.
The big one is the National Register of Historic Places.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got landmarks like that. That could be an entire historic district. Holland, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, Ann Arbor, all have National Register Historic Districts.
Okay.
Okay. National Register Historic District is protective of your property, which means if they wanted to widen the road through the area or in front of your National Historic property, they couldn't do it without getting essentially permission from the federal government. So it's protective. If it's a commercial property, it lets you use historic preservation income tax credits, which are worth 20%. But it doesn't limit what you can do to your house unless you want to use those tax credits. You can do anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
You can leave it up. You can tear it down. You can change the roof pitch. You can add a garage. You can put a 3-story addition on the back. As long as it meets your building code, that's fine. The National Register does not limit you in what you want to do.
Okay.
So I don't have to maintain the historic integrity of the home.
If you want to maintain the value of the home, that's what you'll do.
Yes.
And you'll try to keep that historic character. But you're not going to be required to unless you say you've used that tax credit and you've turned it into a B&B and you're putting a 4-story addition on the back. Well, now you've ruined it. You've blown it. Okay. And you're not going to be eligible for the credit again. You're done. But if you have a local historic district, in Michigan at least, that's where the real teeth are.
Okay.
That's where the historic district commission can say, no, you can't build that garage. Yes, you can fix your front porch. No, you can't replace your windows. They only review what happens on the outside within the boundaries of the local historic district.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so they actually can tell you yes, no, maybe.
Because that's what I'm familiar with.
Right, and that's a lot of people are, but that's just because you're an old house or a historic house doesn't mean it's there, nor does it mean just because you have an old house that there's some big pot of money that you can dip into and they'll give you money to fix up your old house.
It's looked for a big pot of money in my old house, like ripping through walls, because you always think somebody's going to bury something.
Did you look for the rainbow first? Because that'd be a dead giveaway.
No, because I was really looking for money.
Oh.
But I didn't find any. I just want you to know.
Oh, well, I get calls all the time. Well, I've got an old house. Where do I get the money to fix it up? Well, let me tell you. It's a much bigger process than you think. But one of the nice things right here in Michigan right now, we've got a historic preservation income tax credit that has already passed the Senate here in Michigan that would allow homeowners in local historic districts to have a 25% tax credit for work they do on their house in the local historic district.
Well, that's helpful.
Well, if it passes the House, and then it also has to get the governor's signature. But assuming we go all the way through, we had this credit up till 2012, and it was immensely useful to people.
Right.
Lots and lots of people made use of it. So that's the difference. There's the old is anything you think is old.
Right.
And there's two flavors of historic, only one of which actually has any kind of limit to what you want to do to the property as a personal property owner.
Okay, so once it is in the historic designation, you know, in a historic district, is it always like that? So someone who goes and buys a house, if it already has that historic designation, do you have to stick with it? Because we were having this discussion earlier before you got here about, you know, people who buy a house and they say, I don't want that historic designation. Are you just out of luck? You bought a house in a historic district?
Yeah, you're pretty much out of luck because it's like saying, okay, wait a minute, but I want to have a rooming house that holds 14 people. What do you mean I'm not zoned for that? It's like zoning. Okay. It's an overlay of zoning. So you really can't just opt out, at least in Michigan. Some states you can. Mm-hmm. Michigan is not one of them.
All right. See, Betsy, I told you I was probably wrong.
Yes, you
and
did.
We're right. I like being right about that.
Exactly. We're talking historic and old homes on the Repco Light Home Improvement Show. We are lucky enough to have Sharon Ferraro in the studio with us. She is a historic preservation coordinator
for Kalamazoo.
Kalamazoo. I want to be sure that I actually got that title right.
I knew the Kalamazoo part.
Well, so did I. Yeah. I actually worked for Sharon. I did my internship with her a few years ago. So, yes.
I've heard all about that over and over and over. Ad nauseum.
Yeah. Anyway, now why would people want to buy an older home?
Not a historic home, necessarily. Just, in this point talking older homes.
So you can have an old home that's historic.
Right.
And every historic home is, of course, old.
Right.
Okay. So but why would you want an old house over a new house or a newer house? Well, the one really good reason is the fact that the wood that's in an older house, especially if it's built in the 19th or early 20th century, is far superior than the wood that they're using to build houses today. The same species of wood is 30% stronger by testing than the wood that's the same species that they're building from today. So you've got superior framing material. Even if you don't have all the beautiful oak woodwork and everything else, the actual structural material is
the bones of the house.
Secondly, it's already proven itself.
Right.
You know it's going to last. It's already lasted 100 years, maybe with a little bit of repair here and there, a little bit of a touch-up, maybe a more modern kitchen or a more energy-efficient toilet. It could last another 100 years. So you've already got a proven thing.
Right.
Whereas you don't, with a new house, you may not have that as much. I used to talk to the fire marshal that we had in Kalamazoo, and he said, you know, when my guys have to go to a call in an old house, I let them go inside, even if we know there's no people or pets inside. In a new house, if I know there's nobody's life in danger, I don't let them go in because the parts don't hold together as well when they're challenged by a fire.
Well, we were looking, shopping for houses a couple of years ago, and that is exactly one of the things that started to come up in our conversations. You know, with my wife, we would see, okay, this is a newer house. We'd go through a couple, and we started to say, you know what? Let's just start with houses that are this old. You know, let's give a certain range because they've lasted. Because we were seeing things on these newer houses that was not really all that impressive. Now, I know new houses can be built well, but I certainly understand what you're saying there.
Absolutely. And if you think about that, you get a house, say, from 1895 that was built for a middle to low income family. It's going to be, just because of the material that's in it, it's going to be superior to what they're building today in that same income range. So depends on what you have to spend.
So there's a couple of reasons. What else? What other reasons would I want an old house?
Cool.
They are cool.
I agree.
They're just really cool because they've got all that character. They've got the staircases, the woodwork. I mean, if you took a house today and you talked to a developer and you said, okay, I want this. I want it to have this type of oak woodwork, this type of oak staircase, this type of plaster, real plaster on the wall, they'd say, buddy, you can't afford that house. You know, and you've already got it.
Well, and the woodwork, to me, just the details, all of the carvings and things that they used to do. Holy smokes, you just can't find that anymore.
Well, the house, the very first house that we had was about 95, 90 years old and very basic. I mean, it wasn't a big fancy house. Of course not. I lived there. I could afford it. It was just a simple house. But the beauty of some of the detail in the woodwork in just this, what by our standards now is an average house, was amazing. I loved that.
And it's solid. I mean, I had a friend, I had boys. And so they've grown up now. But we had a house that, of course, they wanted to jump from the second floor to the landing halfway down the steps and then down to the first floor. I mean, when you're 9 years old, that's what you do, I guess, you know?
Yep.
And so they did that. And then I had a friend who had a new house that his son was exactly the same way, and he jumped. After a couple years of doing that, he went through to the basement because it was chipboard under carpeting, and what was on my landing was oak over old growth pine. So I mean, he wasn't hurt. He was okay. But still, you know, so it's like, what's the material that it's made from? It may look as good, but is it this, is it the same? And if you can buy something that's older, that's already proven for a similar price or maybe even less than you would pay for something brand new,
why wouldn't you?
Right.
Now, Sharon, we're at the end of our time for this segment. Do you think you can hang with us over the break so we can ask you some more questions?
Oh, sure. No problem.
Perfect. We'll be back in the studio with Sharon Ferraro after the break. Stay tuned.
If you want to take your DIY skills up a rung, the Repco Light Home Improvement Show is here to give you a boost on News Radio Wood 1300 and 106.9 FM.
Welcome back. I'm Dan Hansen.
And I'm Betsy Thompson.
And we're in the studio with Sharon Ferraro, the Historic Preservation Coordinator from Kalamazoo. Thank you, Sharon, for coming back over the break.
Oh, this is fun.
Now, we just were talking about all the good reasons to buy an old house. But I know that there are people listening who are thinking, yeah, that sounds good, but I live in an old house, or it doesn't take much for me to imagine that there's a lot of work involved.
Right.
What are some of the main things that people might run into, and how in the world do we go about fixing this on our own?
Well, keep in mind that whatever old house you choose, was someone living in it before you bought it? Then if they were, and unless they were really frightening people, it's a livable house.
Okay.
So the question is, what do you want to do to it to change it or improve it? And I suggest very strongly that people give at least 6 months to a year living in a house before they start digging in and doing stuff, because you may discover that you think you want to do more than you actually want to do. I would also not watch any DIY shows. I would not watch HGTV, and I would skip this old house.
Okay.
Because that makes you think that, oh my God, we've got to gut this completely to make it livable. And you don't.
Right.
Okay. Then you want to look at, like you would with any house, whether it was new or old, but especially with an old house, you want to look at the box, the shell. Is the roof in good shape? You're done. Are the gutters holding water the way they were supposed to? You're done. Any problems with the foundation? Okay, the box is good. Okay, so now you're talking about what's the cosmetics you want to do? Is there some functionality that you can improve? Do the windows stick a little bit? Do you want to fix the windows? Okay.
What if they're completely painted closed?
Not that hard. I mean, it really isn't. When my mom, who was born in 1924, all she had were sisters, so her dad taught her all of the house fixing skills that he had. She taught me how to replace sash ropes when I was a kid and how to get windows open. I taught my son when he was 10 years old. There's a wonderful video on YouTube called Simple Steps to Working Windows. You can just look it up. It's a 5-part series. About 45 minutes altogether. It was made here in Southwest Michigan down in Kalamazoo, and it's how to fix your windows, how to get open the stuck windows, how do you get that paint broken away. If you want to replace both sets of ropes, it goes you through step by step how to replace the ropes,
how to put
new putty in.
Because my old house, that was long ago, and I was much dumber then, but I finally got them open. Pushed them open, and I heard this weird little popping sound, and then they all slammed shut again. And I had no idea what was going on. I figured it out later. It was these ropes.
The ropes finally gave out. Yeah. Because people will be sloppy. They'll paint the ropes, and then they get stiff, and then they break easily.
Right.
So, but there's tons. I can't tell you how many different websites there are and good advice on how to take care of old houses, step-by-step instructions on how to take care of things. So once you've got the box, you know, your roof, your walls, your foundation is doing good, your systems are working okay, your furnace is working, may not be the most energy efficient in the world, but you know what? Energy efficiency is not the end-all and be-all of everything.
Right.
And make sure your plumbing is good. Electrical wiring, it is a good idea to replace, but do you have to replace it all at once? Well, no. Maybe you can just do a little bit at a time. It took me 10 years to do my house. My house has been completely rewired now.
How old was your house to begin
with? Mine's 1912.
Okay.
It also has a 36,000-gallon in-ground diving pool in the side yard. So,
wow.
Very lucky. This is the only one in the historic district. But you want to look at what's there and then decide, do I really need to do this now? So the biggest advice I can give you if you decide you want to do an old house is make a plan.
Okay.
You know, and if you had an inspection, I'm assuming you had an inspection before you bought the house, and that you looked really hard for an inspector who dealt with old houses and understood old houses and that they're slightly different from a new house, then you've got your plan right there, because the inspector will have outlined everything that needs to be done.
Now, is that something that I can find? How do I find that out about an inspector?
An inspector? Usually your real estate agent will really recommend one. You don't necessarily want the one your agent recommends. You want to call around and find a home inspector that deals with old houses. How often do you deal with old houses, and are you familiar with inspecting them? Because, you know, a lot of them, they just want to upgrade everything to the you know, they want to do this old house on it.
They've been watching. Yes, they've been watching those shows.
And that's not what you want. So, and then just decide what you think you can do yourself. Can you strip wallpaper and paint the walls yourself? Do a little bit of spackling and repair? Yeah, you're good with that. Mm-hmm. You know, but I really don't want to redo the gas lines. I'm uncomfortable doing that. Right. I'm going to hire the pro for that. So decide where you want, what you want to do. First decide what you want to do and what's important. Mm-hmm. And if the only thing on your list is I don't like the color of green in the living room, you're doing great. You know? But if there's something more you want to do, if you want to strip the floors, if you want to refinish them, if you want to repair the front door so that it works better, whatever it is you want to do, make a complete list. And the really helpful thing is to live in the house for a while you're doing that. So you'll be able to decide. You're not going to just jump right out and dig up the whole flower bed because you just don't like where it's positioned. And then you realize that what you're digging up is heirloom bulbs that would have been absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
So same thing with the house. You want to give it a chance to tell you about itself. You know,
okay.
And you can just get by that first year. A little bit drafty, put that plastic stuff over the windows for the first winter. Notice which ones really bulge a lot. So then you're going to know where the air infiltration is happening. Just take notes about the house and then make your plan for what you want to go forward with.
That is really good advice because I think our tendency, you know, right now with all of the home improvement shows, except for this one, of course,
right,
which is the top of the heap, right? But the other ones,
yes,
really, the whole idea is you got to get in there, you got to do these things, you got to rip this stuff down, and you've got to get going now.
Well, that's what everyone thinks when they walk through a house. Oh, I want to change that and that and that.
Yeah, and keep in mind that especially in historic districts, people are looking for old houses because they're old.
Mm-hmm.
If you change that, if you modernize it too much, you're losing value. And appraisers will even tell you this. You're losing value if you change it too much in a historic district.
Okay. So let's say that I buy an old house and I really want to take it back to as close to its original state as possible.
Mm-hmm.
How do I differentiate? This is a big question for me.
Uh-huh.
How do I differentiate between what's historically accurate, you know, to the time period of the home,
right,
and then what's actually been added later? You know, what can I remove and what should I leave there? I want as much value as possible.
Don't we all?
Well, how do you tell what's historic and what you want to keep?
Right.
That's a superb question. You have to look at what's there. And you can tell if it looks all kind of seamless and it's all the similar color. That's probably the original woodwork, you know. A lot of the rest of it, it's kind of hard to tell. But that's one of the reasons I say give it a year. Because that'll give you time to look in books, to look in Old House Journal, to go to the Central Michigan University Archive and look at the Aladdin houses. Mm-hmm. They've got the entire run of catalogs from 1905 to the 1940s. So you can look at the inside pictures and say, well, what's authentic and what's not authentic, and then compare it to what you have. Maybe call in a friend, find another historian that can help you walk through the house and can say, oh, yeah, this is original, this is original, this is original. Oh, my God, no, that kitchen has got to go. You know, whatever it is that you want to do.
Right.
And so that's you're not going to be able to tell right off. And then, again, the second question is, whether it's historic or not, what do you want?
Right.
People ask me all the time, what color should my house be? And I said, well, if it makes you happy to have historic colors, go with historic colors. Whatever color your house is, it should be that when you pull up after being gone for a month on vacation, you sit in that driveway and you say, I'm home. That's the color that house should be.
All right, Sharon, if our listeners have any other questions for you or they're just interested in what they need to know if they're looking to purchase a historic home, how would they get in contact with you?
Actually, the easiest way would probably be through the Old House Network page, which is OHN2003@att.net.
All right, perfect. Sharon Ferraro, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk about old homes with us.
I really enjoyed it.
Well, Betsy, are you crying because the segment's over or because the whole show is over?
No, I got dust in my eye.
Yeah, you're crying because the show's over. Anyway, if any of you would like to relive all of the thrills and excitement of this episode, just head to repcolite.com and you can catch every single episode we've ever recorded. Go there now. It's worth it.
And make sure you go to Repcolite's Facebook page and ask us your question. Maybe we'll answer it next week and you'll win $50.
Whatever you do, paint is going to make it happier and more fulfilling. So head to a Repcolite or Port City Paint store near you and find that part of your life that's just been missing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Dan Hansen.
And I'm Betsy Thompson. Remember, if you're about to lose your DIY sanity, we can help you fix that crazy.
And we'll help you realize that dream that you didn't even know you had about riding in a one-horse open hot tub sled.
Oh, good grief.
And if you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and check out segment one.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.